This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, good evening. Welcome to the Osher Mini Medical School, the second in a series of lectures. The topic for this evening is going to be on anticoagulants. My name is Steve Kaiser. I am a member of the School of Pharmacy faculty. I'm a professor emeritus in the School of Pharmacy, and I've been involved with the management of patients on these drugs for a number of years. And throughout my career, I've seen a number of changes. And in the recent past, in the recent few months, there, in fact, have been some significant changes in medications. So the topic of the presentation is anticoagulants. And I thought I would begin by giving an example of something that happens probably to all of us, hopefully fairly infrequently, but is a fairly common presentation. And this is an example of a man, Mr. Smith, who is building a chicken cage. And suddenly the saw that's in his hand slips, and he cuts his hand, as you might anticipate, and perhaps is what you've experienced. It begins to bleed. So what actually stops the bleeding? Before we get into our discussion of agents which might be used to prevent blood clotting, I thought we'd use this example to give us an entry into what stops the bleeding. The picture that I've illustrated on this slide shows a free-flowing freeway, rare in the Bay Area, and then one that's stopped because of an accident. Now, most of us, during our daily routine, the blood will be flowing through freely through our blood vessels, and it doesn't stop. But when something happens, perhaps it's an injury such as cutting our hand, sawing, building a chicken coop, or working in the kitchen, it releases a number of substances which results in a clogging of the arteries and essentially a clot. And we'll talk about this in greater detail as we go along. So blood clotting is really a complex series of events, and we continually are balancing blood clotting with bleeding. And as we get into our discussion of medications used to prevent clots, anticoagulants, this is going to be our real goal, is to prevent a clot from forming, but also prevent the extreme, and that is any kind of bleeding. Also, when there is tissue damage, we must balance the extent of tissue damage along with clotting that occurs in an effort to stop the bleeding. There are three main components that must be present for a clot to form. One is generally some type of trauma, which can be either external trauma, cutting our hand with a saw, or internal trauma to the blood vessels, which might occur in some cases where the blood vessel is coated with cholesterol plaques, which break down, or some other obstruction to or blockage in the flow. There can be bleeding and clotting as a result. Good clotting is what we want. Bad clotting is what we want to avoid. And so you can see this balance, this scale, which balances the clotting with the bleeding. We have a number of natural elements in our body which are circulating around, which antagonize a clot. And this balance is subsequently maintained with those triggers for clotting. Now, this slide shows that floating around, there are a number of different elements. As can be seen on the slide, there are elements, there are white blood cells, which really don't participate in the clotting process. They, as perhaps you recall from last week's presentation, are the first line of defense for infections, and so those are floating around. There are various other elements, platelets, smaller pieces that contribute to clotting. And these platelets become a target for the use of certain medications such as aspirin, which is used to treat certain types of and to prevent certain types of clotting disorders, and we will talk about that in a little bit greater detail. And then there are red blood cells. There are proteins called fibrin, and all of these come together, the fibrin and the platelets in particular, come together and are what contribute to the formation of a clot. So when we look for medications to help prevent clotting, we are really looking for medicines which will target those elements and decrease their activity so that there is not a clot which results in any kinds of symptoms. So as long as this is flowing smoothly and there's no trigger to disrupt this balance between these elements, it's very unlikely that a clot will form. So these are the good clots. These, you know, not all clots are bad. But these are the good clots, so that if there's a disruption, if there's a breakage in the blood vessel wall, these elements tend to gather and create a meshwork which helps prevent and further bleeding and allow tissue recovery, tissue healing to take place. So let's talk about another patient. So this is patient MM, who has recently returned from Australia. And anyone who's traveled to Australia probably recognizes that this is a rather long air flight and sitting in a cramped airplane. Following the flight, she noticed some swelling in her left calf, which is illustrated in the picture, and you can see that the size of the calves are different. She went to the emergency department where a scan of her leg showed a blood clot and a diagnosis of a DVT, or deep vein thrombosis, was made. So this is a clot that normally you would see these elements flowing freely through the leg. In this case, there is something which triggers them to become sticky, and they collect at a site of injury and subsequently form a clot. That clot makes the passage of blood difficult, and that results in the swelling because the blood cannot return or cannot pass by that clot, and it creates a distension. It creates a stretching of the blood vessel. Sometimes that clot can fragment. It can break down into smaller clots, which can travel further from the site where the injury has occurred and eventually can be caught up or lodged into another smaller blood vessel, and we'll show where some of those are in just a moment. So the question now is, since this patient has presented with this clot, what should we do, what can we do, and what are our options? So blood clots can occur as a result. This is often referred to as economy class syndrome. And so it behooves us all to fly first class, but that's not always economically feasible, or it's rare that we have the opportunity to do that. So ways to prevent that are to get up and move around, but nonetheless, it occurs when in cramped quarters, as illustrated by this cartoon. If the blood clot goes to the lungs, we call that a pulmonary or lung embolus or clot. They can go to the brain, which can cause a stroke. Some patients who have irregular heartbeats, a syndrome called atrial fibrillation, sometimes a blood clot can form and it can create a stroke. Any condition which occurs with the presence of these three variables, stasis or a slowing down of blood flow, injury, which can be, as I've already mentioned, external outside the blood vessel or internal to the blood vessel, and something that creates or causes the coagulation cascade, the factors which result in a clot to become hyperactive. Many of you may know or may remember who Richard Nixon was. Well, he had a clot, and we were actually consulted to help in the management of some of his anticoagulant medications. Atrial fibrillation, which I mentioned is an irregularity in the heartbeat, is very commonly occurs as we age, and it may actually occur and is up to 40 to 50% of patients over the age of 65. So there is a big role for the use of these anticoagulants, and as important, or more importantly, using them properly. So when are blood clots bad? Well, anytime they block the flow of blood. As our patient MM illustrates, if it blocks the flow in the legs, it can create swelling. Swelling itself, for a short period of time, is not necessarily, it's not horrible, but if it's not treated promptly, it can result in chronic swelling and further problems. The biggest goal is to prevent that clot from breaking loose and traveling to either the lungs or to another part of the body. Strokes, of course, there's a great deal of emphasis on early treatment of strokes, and we'll talk about what clot busters are a little bit later in our discussion. So what are anticoagulants? The definition of an anticoagulant is a substance that hinders the clotting of blood. So that's a fairly general, fairly broad definition of what these drugs actually are. We sometimes refer to them as blood thinners, and perhaps this is what caught your eye or piqued your interest in the use of these medications or what you've heard. At the risk of disappointing everyone, they actually do not thin the blood. If you were to take the blood of a patient on an anticoagulant and compare it to the blood in a test tube of a patient who is taking an anticoagulant, they would look exactly the same. It's not the difference between molasses and water. So it's very descriptive, and it's very tempting to use this. I actually discourage using this terminology in patients that I see, because I think it implies, I think people perhaps become a little bit frightened if they think their blood is now like water. So they don't really thin the blood, but they slow down the likelihood of a clot forming and allows our normal internal elements to help prevent that from progressing. There's many different types of anticoagulants. I know that most everyone who watches any television has seen ads for these new drugs, these new anticoagulant drugs. Those are just one of a number. So we'll talk a little bit about what they really do, and we'll talk about what clot busters are. So the types of anticoagulants. Well, we can give anticoagulants by mouth, or we can give them by vein. And our decision to use one by vein versus using it by mouth is usually prompted by what our sense of urgency is. For example, the patient MM who developed this blood clot in their leg, we know that if we start a medication by vein or by injection, it doesn't always have to go into a vein, but by injection, we can achieve a level of anticoagulation very promptly that is more likely to prevent that blood clot from getting bigger or breaking up and going someplace else. If we give a medicine by mouth, as is true of many medicines that we give by mouth, there can be a lag time before they begin to work. So that's one decision that we need to make when selecting an anticoagulant drug. There are medications which do affect platelets, primarily aspirin. We will talk a little bit more about aspirin, but there's a lot of publicity. There's a lot of information about, should everyone take aspirin? You know, aspirin for all. And then there's another one called Plavix, which is an antiplatelet agent. There are some other medicines called some injectable medications, enoxaparin or Lovenox. And then there's a whole number of oral anticoagulants. So as we go along, I'll try to illustrate where these may play. Now, you may notice a picture, and perhaps you've all recognized this as a leech. Well, leeches are, in the world of anticoagulation, leeches are our friends. We actually have leeches that we occasionally use, but we don't use them specifically to treat blood clots that occur in the vein. But from leeches, we have identified, and from the saliva of bats, we've identified medicines which are very effective in decreasing, in breaking down clots. Now, for the biochemists in the audience, or for those who are interested in the physiology of clotting, I always feel somewhat obligated to show this just on general principles, but there won't be a test on it. What I want to do, this illustrates all of the elements that commonly contribute and participate in forming a clot. And there's 13 different clotting proteins which contribute to the formation of a clot. When we develop medications, when we develop drugs, we generally, on general principles, we're developing drugs that target something. They target cholesterol, or they target an infectious organism, a bacteria. In this case, we have developed a number of medications which target anticoagulants. And as I go through these next few buttons, it will light up where certain drugs work to interfere with the evolution or the growth of a clot. So it's actually fairly complex. So when we choose one drug over another, one anticoagulant over another, what we are doing is taking into account which of these elements they influence, and sometimes take advantage of using two different kinds to more effectively reduce the likelihood of a clot or decrease the likelihood of clotting, or we avoid them because they work at the same place and there's no need to duplicate. So there are many things. Most of these are lit up, and they're identified by Roman numerals, 1 through 13, not all of them on this slide. But there are other elements, tissue factor. And you can see on the left-hand side of the slide the types of medications that we will use to target those. So it's a very complex series of events. But most importantly, as a patient or as a family member, caregiver, or as a health professional, it's important to understand that there are many different sites where these medications could work. And it's important that we appropriately select them.
Where does the vitamin K fit into that schema?
Okay. The question is, where does vitamin K fit into this schema of various clotting proteins? Well, there are four of these clotting proteins, factor 2, 7, 9, and 10, require vitamin K for their manufacture. We have a medication called warfarin or Coumadin, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a moment, specifically targets the relationship between vitamin K and the manufacture of these blood clotting elements. So that's where vitamin K. Now, we all have vitamin K. We get it in our diet. It's not something that we typically need to supplement with a vitamin. It's in green leafy vegetables, some wheat products, and fish. And we absorb enough that helps us manufacture normally these clotting proteins. But it is that's the relationship of vitamin K, and we do target that with warfarin, which we'll talk about in a moment. So aspirin. Which one and who should take it? Well, anyone who's walked down the shelves of a pharmacy or even a local supermarket will see that there are lots of different types of aspirin products. My advice is generally to purchase the one which is the least expensive. That despite claims to the contrary, aspirin is aspirin is aspirin. Now, we could, from a manufacturing basis, we could say, well, maybe there some are a little bit better absorbed, but in general, they're all the same. It comes in lots of different, as illustrated here, there's a women's aspirin, which has some buffering agents. There's low-dose aspirin. There's standard-dose aspirin. There are quite a few aspirin products. And again, if you just walk down the aisle and look at these, you'll notice that they can vary significantly in price. So generic aspirin is generally what we recommend, or what I recommend. It works against platelets. So in the patient that we talked about, MM, who developed a deep vein thrombosis, that involves a triggering of a number of these blood clotting proteins. Platelets play less of a role in the development of that type of clot, and therefore, aspirin doesn't work very well to treat a clot that is established and is creating a blockage in the veins or in the lungs. So we don't use that. So who should take aspirin? Well, if you have had a heart attack, aspirin has been shown, because in the blood vessels that provide nutrients to the heart, the coronary arteries, the heart arteries, they're much smaller. They become lined with cholesterol, and the irregular surface that results because of this buildup of cholesterol causes platelets to get lazy in a way, or they become trapped, they become hung up, not a professional term, but they become attached to the fat in the cholesterol that builds up in the arteries, and they become very sticky. So aspirin's very good for that. So if you've had a heart attack, often aspirin is used to help prevent another one. If you've had a stroke, many types of strokes, aspirin or an agent influencing platelets will be useful. If you have had a stent, a cardiac stent, where a small tube has been introduced and placed into the coronary artery, that surface becomes, it's not a rejection type issue, but the surface can attract platelets for a period of time. And so aspirin is very effective in reducing that likelihood. If you've undergone coronary artery bypass surgery in order to prevent an occlusion, a blockage in the grafts, which are introduced surgically, aspirin may be very useful. If you have significant risk factors for a stroke, or if you have diabetes and you are a man over the age of 50 or a woman over the age of 60 with major risk factors, you may benefit from aspirin. And the major risk factors we're really talking about are smoking, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, obesity, physical inactivity. Clearly, smoking, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol are the major risk factors. So we've drawn back a little bit. Rather than saying everybody should be taking aspirin, we are now thinking a little bit more closely about what is the actual risk of a person having a heart attack. So it can be helpful. Why not? Why shouldn't everybody take aspirin? You know, you can get it without a prescription. Interestingly, I think that if aspirin were discovered today, it would not be available without a prescription, that it would go to the FDA and they would probably declare that it requires a prescription. But why not? Well, patients who have, it can cause bleeding, it can cause ulcers in some patients, and so patients who have a history of ulcer disease in the stomach should not take aspirin. There are certain types of stroke. You can develop a stroke because of a blood clot, or there can be bleeding. Patients, for example, who have very high, uncontrolled high blood pressure are those who are more likely to develop a stroke where there's actually, because of the pressure, there's a bleeding, and that, of course, you would not use aspirin.
Can I ask a question? What's the mechanism of aspirin that's antiplatelet? How does it really work?
Okay, good question. So the question is, how does aspirin really work? Well, since you asked, I'll tell you, but and I'm not familiar with your background, but it actually inhibits, there's a prostaglandin that stimulates the production of, there's good elements, there's something called prostacycline, and there's something called thromboxane. And they are stimulated by the production of, there are types of prostaglandins which aspirin interferes with the bad prostaglandin, thromboxane, and helps to maintain the concentration of the good one, the prostacycline. It, once again, it's kind of that balance. Now, and I'm glad that you asked the question, because it's very dependent upon the dose. I think oftentimes there's a perception with some things anyway that if a little's good, a lot's better. This is definitely not true with aspirin. So the dosage of aspirin that we generally recommend that most favorably influences this balance and prevents blood clots is a lower dose, around 81 milligrams. Now, that sounds very specific. It's in Europe, it's 75, and in many other parts of the world, but say 80 milligrams. 325 milligrams is the standard dosage of a tablet of aspirin. Is that too much? Probably not, but 81 is all you need and maybe a little bit safer. You should not take aspirin if you're taking other anticoagulant drugs in general. There are some exceptions. Certain other medications associated with bleeding. Any medication which has an irritant effect on the stomach, taking aspirin along with it can make that worse. And it's not for venous blood clots, as I mentioned. If a person has a deep vein thrombosis, aspirin doesn't really work to help alleviate the symptoms of that. Some have suggested that, well, if we know that aspirin can cause an irritation in the stomach, why not take a proton pump inhibitor, a class of medications that helps prevent acid buildup? And in general, we do not recommend that unless there is something about you as a patient or a person as a patient that shows that you have an increased risk. Because what that does is that introduces yet another drug. And so quickly the number of drugs adds up very too fast. And they can be expensive. So it's an unneeded expense in most people. But there are some in whom it may be beneficial. And it also, of course, depends upon other medications that you're taking. What about warfarin? Warfarin or Coumadin, it's kind of an interesting history. So I'll just spend a moment going through that. When I see patients, first thing I say is, you do know that we're giving you rat poison, don't you? Because it was actually developed as a rat poison, but it was discovered on the prairies of Canada in the 20s in the northern plains when farmers and ranchers noticed that their previously healthy cattle started dying from internal bleeding. And, of course, this was an economic hardship to them, and particularly this during the Depression. They were losing their livelihood by these animals suddenly dying. So they contacted the University of Wisconsin, and they discovered that cattle fed damp, sweet clover hay, which normally would have been discarded, but because of the hardships, the economic hardships, it was used as a cattle feed, contained a type of clover. And it took a while before they were able to put this all together, but they went to this scientist named Carl Link, who was able to crystallize the active ingredient. And subsequently, it was identified to be a coumarin-type chemical. And I'm going to jump ahead for just a moment, but because University of Wisconsin discovered it, the name came from Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. Subsequently, the University of Wisconsin, I don't know how much, but I'm sure that they reaped some financial benefits from that, and it was called warfarin. And then DuPont purchased the rights to manufacture it, and because it's a coumarin-type chemical, they called it Coumadin. And then, because of the enterprising farmers and ranchers who realized that they had lots of rats on their farms that they couldn't get rid of, they decided to use it as a rat poison as well. So the patent rights for it were assigned in 1941. First, it was promoted as a rodenticide. Then it was approved for human use. And in 1955, perhaps one of the early, most famous people who received it was Dwight Eisenhower after a heart attack. And it was commonly quoted that what was good for a war hero and the president of the United States must be good for all, despite being a rat poison. And it then became used more popularly. And so it's been around for quite some time. And we've learned a great deal about it over the years, which gives us some increased confidence in how to perhaps use it most safely or more safely. But it nonetheless is a risky drug. So this is a picture of the different tablet strengths that it comes in. I'm not sure they're really necessary, but there are a number of tablet strengths available. My concern is that they can sometimes confuse us as well as patients. Warfarin is known as a drug with a narrow index for efficacy. Too much of it can create problems of bleeding. Not enough of it can create problems with clotting. So we need to keep this balance in mind. And it is responsible for a number of bad reactions which occur in patients who have to come in with bleeding. But we do know how to manage that. So once again, it's balancing. So how do we dose it? It's interesting. As I see patients, and I see patients in an anticoagulation clinic, which is really dedicated to managing these types of medications on a weekly basis, and saw patients this morning. And so I thought it might be interesting to share with you some patients. A 45-year-old man with a history of atrial fibrillation, this irregular heartbeat, requires 7.5 milligrams of warfarin every day. An 82-year-old woman with a history of several blood clots in her lungs requires 4 milligrams. A 67-year-old man with a history of a heart valve problem requires 1 milligram a day. And a 55-year-old woman with a history of stroke requires 5 milligrams a day. So really, all over the board. And so what is it that determines it? What is it that helps us in selecting the right dosage for patients? And so why is my dosage of warfarin so different from Joe's or Mary's? And occasionally patients will compare notes and say, well, since everybody's in our clinic because they're taking warfarin, they'll say, well, how much are you taking? And they'll say one, and somebody will say another, and they'll think, well, gosh, I'm getting 4 times as much as you are. They must be giving me too much. Or the other person may say, well, they're only giving me a quarter of what you're receiving, so I'm probably not getting enough. Well, it's not quite that simple, and we do use a blood test to help us guide it. But if you were to line up a number of people and try to predict by looking at their sex, male or female, their height, their weight, their age, you would be hard-pressed, I think, to accurately predict what the dosage is. So my mantra is it needs to be individualized. And we're treating each person individually and as on the result of their medical history, other medications, and various other factors, and the results of blood tests, we come up with the correct dose. So there are a number of questions which come up. What about my diet? Already there's been a question about vitamin K. We get vitamin K in our foods, and how could that influence it? How do we manage complicated medication regimens and avoid drug interactions? Drug interactions are a problem with any complicated medication regimen. It could be a very simple medication regimen, just the wrong choice of two medicines. So we need to carefully look for anything that we can avoid, any interactions that we can avoid. Age, sex, weight, smoking have a little but not a great deal of effect. How do we manage travel in patients who are taking anticoagulants, and what about activities? We'll try and touch on a number of these. I think one of the major advances, and one that's stimulated a great deal of interest for us here at UCSF, is how we can help really personalize medicine regimens for a patient. How can we be more precise in not only selecting a drug, but selecting the right dosage? And so there's been a great deal of interest in the influence of genetics. And, of course, all the breakthroughs in the identification of various diseases and disease processes on the basis of genetics have helped us advance therapy. This is also true for warfarin or for Coumadin. And this pie diagram illustrates some of the major factors which do influence this dosing. And 40% of this pie is taken up by two elements. One is VCOR-C1 and the other is CYP2C9. And it's not really important to remember those, but those are two of the genetic components which influence our response to warfarin. So the big question is, if we can measure those, does it help us? And the short answer is not very much, which is very disappointing. We were very enthusiastic, as was, I think, the professional community, that this would be the answer. And I think we probably all know that it's rare that something is the absolute answer. But it does help us in explaining why there may be some differences. But unfortunately, it doesn't help us as much as we had hoped. Other factors account for as large a component of this pie. In fact, a few percentage points more, so 44%. So, and those other factors include diet, they include medications, they include the presence or absence of certain disease states, the presence or absence of acute type illnesses. Age and weight have an influence that accounts for a certain percentage as well. The bottom line, I think what this illustrates is that there are multiple factors, all of which must be taken into account. So what about genetics? Well, I mentioned that it accounts for about 40% of the dose prediction. Weight and age account for 16%, and other factors make up the rest. What it has, our knowledge of how genetics can be different amongst various ethnic groups, has actually, despite the fact that we do not measure the actual activity, it has given us some information about how to begin dosing patients. And for example, we know that the average dosage for a Caucasian is 5 milligrams a day. The average dosage for an Asian is about 50% of that, or 2.5 milligrams. And the average dosage for an African American is about 40% more, almost 50% more than a Caucasian, so about 7.5 milligrams. Now, you know, in our society, particularly in San Francisco, we're really a melting pot. And so there's an influence of many different ethnicities, not only in many individuals. So these are average dosages, but it does help us begin the treatment in patients. Once again, it's not routinely useful to do genotyping or genetic testing. And once again, I'll express my disappointment that it didn't prove to be more useful, but we're still looking at it, but it just hasn't been as useful as we thought. Just a couple of comments about diet. Well, as I mentioned, warfarin antagonizes the clotting proteins, which are dependent upon vitamin K. We do get vitamin K in our diet. That comes from a number of sources, many of which are illustrated on this slide. Maintaining a consistent balance is really what we recommend. It is not necessary for patients who are taking warfarin to avoid these foods. And this is a matter of contention and contradiction amongst many of us who practice, but it really is not necessary. And it does impose somewhat of a hardship on people who, these are healthy foods. We're encouraging a healthy lifestyle, healthy diet. So it is not necessary to completely avoid these, but to maintain some consistency. The biggest dietary influence is not eating anything, fasting, and not taking in any nutrients, or when a patient has an illness and has lost their appetite and is unable to eat. That has a much greater influence on the amount that you eat. What about interactions with warfarin? I kind of like this because it says, is it the medications that I'm taking that are making me feel sick, or is it the symptoms of the disease? Sometimes it's hard to tell. With warfarin, it's kind of, I think of it sometimes as a good news, bad news drug. The good news is it really does have few side effects. The bad news is it's bleeding, and bleeding's not good. So that's why our efforts are dedicated so strongly in trying to prevent bleeding. Medicines. As we age, we take more medicines. Medications can be good. They can sometimes do harm. With warfarin, it's very important for us to know what those medications are and to help balance them. Alcohol can influence the way warfarin works, and also over-the-counter medications, and especially herbal-type medicines or nutritional supplements, which are very popular. In many cases, if a patient is really dedicated to taking them, we can work around it. But I think my approach is generally to determine what we know about it and explain that, and also determine if it's really likely to be doing any benefit. So drug interactions, 1 + 1 is not always 2. Sometimes you can, if you add an additional drug to the regimen of someone who is taking warfarin or Coumadin, it can work way too much. Some do not allow it to work. Timing is important when these medications are taken. So it's a very complex relationship, and I would encourage anyone who has a question to discuss this with their provider. Discuss it when you pick up your prescription with the pharmacist and make sure that, in fact, there are no drug interactions. And I would just ask explicitly, do you see any drug interactions in my regimen? Just to clarify and make sure that someone is paying attention to those. Some of the most common drug interactions are antibiotics, which can interfere with warfarin. Oftentimes, patients who are taking antibiotics are taking them, hopefully, not requiring them, but if they are for an infection, it's because there may likely be a fever or a change in appetite, which factors which can influence it. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Advil or Aleve or ibuprofen or naproxen are often very helpful in relieving acute pain. They relieve fever. They relieve inflammation. If someone is taking a drug like warfarin, they can also irritate the stomach. And irritation of the stomach can result in bleeding, and warfarin can make that worse. So it's wise to avoid these. And if there's a need, if a person feels like they need something, they should discuss it with very carefully with the pharmacist or with their physician or their other providers to make sure that it's okay. Some heart medicines can also interfere. How to manage them? Generally, avoid them. If it's not necessary to take a medication, I strongly recommend that you do not. If it's a nutritional supplement, you need to have a discussion with someone to find out if it's necessary, if it's likely to achieve the goal that you are looking for. Herbal medications, unfortunately, we just don't know as much as we should. Herbal medications also are not standardized generally, and so content can vary. In many cases, we can work with you as a patient to allow you to take them, but we want to make sure that we know what the source is, that they are in fact safe. And unfortunately, there's just not a lot known. So ask lots of questions. In almost every case where a medication is prescribed or recommended that does interfere with warfarin, we do have options. We have alternatives. But what's important is maintaining this dialogue, asking the questions, anticipating that it may be interfering. And then we just monitor the patient a little bit more closely and change the dose if necessary. There are some sites, a website. There's one called Drug Interactions Checker, which is online, which is actually not too bad. So for as a patient, I think we're entitled to look for information and gather what we can. But once again, I would strongly encourage you to discuss this with your provider. Acute illness in warfarin. Again, if an acute illness occurs, then it's important to let your provider know, because it can influence how the warfarin, the intensity of the effect of the warfarin, and we would like to avoid it causing any bleeding, so it's important to bring up. So what about monitoring? And this gets to the question of the INR. The INR, what it stands for is International Normalized Ratio, and not important to remember that. But I think the key word here is international, at least in my mind, because what this test has allowed us to be able to do is to measure what the intensity, how well the warfarin is working, but it allows us to really compare it all over the world. So we have patients who are not, if you were on warfarin, you don't have to be homebound. Hopefully it's preventing blood clots, so you can be out of the home. You can travel and do things. But you can measure this. The blood test can be performed all over the world, and the INR is an INR is an INR. There are several ways to do this. One, it can be done in a laboratory by taking a blood sample by vein. It can be done in a physician's office, an anticoagulation clinic. Patients can do it at home on themselves. All it requires is a drop of blood and a machine that's illustrated here. And in fact, this is the machine that we use. And in fact, this is me doing it in the clinic. And we can give a patient an instantaneous answer to how well the Coumadin is working, how well the warfarin is working. So we know that if you do not take warfarin, we can measure this blood test, the INR, and it is the normal result in a person not taking warfarin is 1. It's a ratio, so it's a ratio of 1. We know from experience that in order to most effectively decrease the likelihood of a clot, and at the same time, most likely prevent any bleeding, that if we extend this blood test from 1 to between 2 and 3, and this can vary, there's a different range for patients who have heart valve replacements, for example, but for the sake of discussion, as illustrated here, if we can keep it between 2 and 3, we can minimize the likelihood of a clot, at the same time minimizing the likelihood of bleeding. If it goes above 4, generally the chance of bleeding is higher. If it goes below 2, generally a little bit less than that, 1.8, the chance of a blood clot is higher. So that is why we measure it, and that is the range that we aim for. Now, as illustrated on the previous slide, there are many things which can influence that. Diet can influence it a little bit. Other medicines can influence it. Of course, not taking it or taking the wrong dosage can influence it. Alcohol can sometimes influence it. So when I meet with a patient, as I did today, I will go through a series of questions, and we will discuss it, and we will look for any changes that might be taking place, and then we measure it. And that really guides us as to whether or not the dosage needs to be adjusted. Now, the frequency of testing can vary amongst individuals. Patients who have a little bit more erratic response tend to require more frequent testing. Those who are stable require less frequent testing. But that's what the INR is. As a person, I'm not taking warfarin, but I believe very strongly that a patient who is taking warfarin absolutely needs to know what that blood test number is. They need to indelibly imprint it in their mind so they know, so they can tell people, not to the extent where they are thinking about it every moment, but they, as a consumer of the medication, they really do need to know what the test result is.
I don't want to be a pain in the neck, but how do they actually get those numbers, like 2, 3, 4? How do they arrive at that?
Okay, good question. The question is, how do we actually come up with these numbers? How do we know that 2 to 3 is where it should be? Well, most of it comes from a great deal of experience. And that is, when the test was first developed, and it actually comes from a test called the prothrombin that was developed by Armand Quick, who was a biochemist. And they actually gave the medication and measured the blood test, and they said, ooh, we didn't give enough, the clot's coming back, or we gave too much, we're seeing too much bleeding. So the initial results are what prompted further study to look where what that window was. Early on, when we first started using this INR, it was felt that it should be higher. For example, up to 4.5. And we realized that in reality, we were just seeing more bleeding, but it was no more effective based upon the groups of patients who were randomized, who were directed to take it enough to get it into another range and then compare it with the others. So since warfarin's been around for quite some time, we've accumulated a great deal of information about this. And furthermore, we're developing new develops, for example, in heart valves, where we're thinking of decreasing the intensity of the INR based upon this experiment. But it's literally come from observational studies where patients have been selected to be in a different group. And we've
extrapolated from the protons. I'm an old technician,
so... Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, so the question was, is it extrapolated from protons? And very specifically to your question, yes. In fact, the ratio is the prothrombin time of the patient over the laboratory normal. And then it's each, for those who may additionally be interested, in order to perform the test, you have to use something called tissue thromboplastin. And tissue thromboplastin comes from various sources. It comes from rabbit brain, different places, and it has different sensitivity. And the industry has created something called the International Sensitivity Index, or ISI. So this ratio is raised exponentially to this ISI, which is assigned to each batch of tissue thromboplastin that's purchased, and that's what gives us the ratio. So yes, it is. It does ultimately come from the prothrombin time. Does that answer your question, or? Okay, so warfarin, again, one of the side effects is bleeding, but I've amongst the many things that I've potentially said which may be confusing, I think there are two which are perhaps the most. One is anticoagulants are not blood thinners. Warfarin does not cause bleeding. You can definitely bleed when you're taking warfarin, but warfarin does not cause the blood cells to come apart and blood to seep out into the environment. You must have some type of injury. Something must disrupt those blood vessel walls for bleeding to occur. So it may seem like a minor point or just semantics, but I think it's important to realize that just because your INR, your blood test, is high, doesn't mean that you will have bleeding. There needs to be some kind of injury. But if you do get that injury, it can be fairly mild, bumping into the corner of a dresser or a door frame, or being on the bus and stumbling, or something like that, then there can be some bleeding. And so patients do need to be aware of where bleeding can occur and what to do. In general, it's direct pressure. If it's in the stomach, of course, you can't do that. But if it's a bruise or something like that, applying direct pressure and ice. And, of course, if the bleeding does not stop, calling 911. We do recommend that patients who are on warfarin wear a medic alert, a bracelet or a necklace, something that acknowledges that you are taking one of these in case you're involved in an accident and emergency personnel are trained to look for these. So there's a number of pros and cons of warfarin. The pros are that you can monitor it. There's lots of experience. There's an antidote. We've talked about the relationship with vitamin K. If the warfarin works too well, we can decrease this effect with vitamin K or reverse it. It's cheap, very effective, has few side effects. Take it once a day. Some of the cons is that you do need to monitor it. So we need to see you periodically. And for most patients, that's not too bad. We get to know each other. You get to ask questions. There are drug interactions and food interactions, and there can be bleeding. And you shouldn't take it if you're pregnant because it may have an effect on the fetus. And you need to use it carefully if you or be aware of that if you need any kind of surgical procedure, that it may need to be interrupted. So clot busters. Clot busters are medications which are used to treat patients who have the acute onset of a stroke. These are medicines which actually dissolve the clot. They're very potent in their use in patients with a stroke. They must be used to work. They work the best if they're used within the first hour of the onset of symptoms. So being aware of the signs of a stroke, facial drooping, weakness, slurred speech, they should draw your attention, or if you see somebody who does, to seek medical attention quickly. These are medicines like TPA, you may have heard of this name, that need to be administered very promptly in an environment where there are very well-trained individuals who are familiar with its use. There are a number of new anticoagulants. You may have seen this television commercial for a drug called Pradaxa. They're directed for people who have a history of atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular heartbeat. They do have some advantages, which we'll go through in a moment. The other names are Eliquis or Xarelto. So there's three of them, and I thought this kind of cartoon pretty much put it into perspective. And it says, this is one of those new miracle drugs. If you can afford it, it's a miracle. So not unlike many new medicines, it's very expensive. But, you know, on the other hand, if it's really good, maybe cost is a little bit less of an issue. But nonetheless, it is. This is what they're used for. Some of them are used for atrial fibrillation. Several of them are used in the treatment of DVT. Some are used in patients who undergo surgery, orthopedic surgery, for example. So it really needs to be individualized for a patient. And some of the advantages, some of the pros, they do not require monitoring. Warfarin requires monitoring. These, you just take it and run. Not literally, but it's not necessary to measure it with a blood test to establish the intensity of its effect. On the other hand, you can't. So if you suspect that the dosage is incorrect, you really cannot confirm that with a blood test. There are fewer drug interactions, fewer dietary interactions with these medicines. Those are both nice because we still need to look at other medicines a patient's taking. But there are fewer drugs which actually interfere. It's not necessary to worry about your diet. On the other hand, as I said earlier, I don't think you need to worry about it very much when you're on warfarin. But you can really ignore it. It has a short duration of action, so it wears off if you stop taking it, which can be a disadvantage as well. And they're effective and better than warfarin for some patients, but not all patients. If a patient has a very erratic INR for some reason, it may be that these agents would be better to use because of that erratic response. So what are the cons? They are expensive. You cannot measure them. They do have a short duration of action. So if you miss a dose or two, there's a chance that you could have a recurrence, a repeat of the blood clot. There's no antidote for it. So with warfarin, if the intensity is too big, we can give vitamin K. With these agents, we have medications that we try, but they're not specific. It's dangerous with kidney problems. So if you have abnormal kidney function, they may require dosage adjustment. Bleeding in the stomach with two of them is more than you see with warfarin. You need to avoid in pregnancy, and several of them you need to take twice a day. So warfarin you take once a day. These you need to take twice a day. So as with any medication, there's a risk and there's a benefit. And there's something, and it's very important to sit down and discuss those. Pradaxa has been in the news because despite its claims of safety and superiority, it has in fact been associated with some bleeding problems, a higher incidence of certain types of bleeding problems, particularly in the stomach, than with warfarin. And in the Bloomberg Press, Boehringer, just the company who makes it, just paid $650 million to get rid of the cases that they didn't want to deal with. What about natural anticoagulants? You know, wouldn't it be nice if we could just rely on nature to help us out? Well, there have been claims for the role of natural anticoagulants. Garlic, for example. Well, I'm afraid to disappoint those who might be saying, great, I'll just chew a couple of cloves of garlic a day and that'll be it. I won't have to worry about any of these poisons. Well, it just doesn't work. Garlic, it's often included in lists of substances to avoid when you're taking warfarin, but quite honestly, you'd have to eat a lot of garlic. And I don't think that would be pleasant, let alone not work. Ginseng, there's lots of different preparations of ginseng. When patients ask me about it, I get a little bit worried about which one it is, and I cannot honestly tell you the absolute content in a root versus a powder versus a different preparation. So it goes back to something I said a moment ago. We really don't know. It could be fine or it might not be, but we really don't know. So it's really an issue of discussing it and determining how important it is. Fish oils, anybody, all you just have to read the newspaper. One day they're good, the other day they're not so good. Then one day they're better, one day they're not worth anything. Well, there are certain patients in which fish oils may be very useful. They also may influence platelets and subsequently increase the chance of some bleeding which might occur if you're taking another anticoagulant. Does that mean you cannot take them in combination? No, not necessarily, but it's something that we need to be aware of and something that we can provide some advice on what to look for and what dosage to take, for example. Ginger, dong kai, I think it's pronounced, and feverfew are also a couple of preparations which there's some evidence that they may interfere. But in most cases, it's not a significant interference. But rather just endorsing that it's okay to take these, I think the important take-home message is that you really do need to sit down and talk with your provider and look at the information together to determine if it's something good to use. So approaches to anticoagulant therapy, as we conclude. We've talked really about coagulation activation mostly, about thrombin generation and fibrin formation for which we use anticoagulant drugs. We did mention about clot busters or thrombolytics, and a little bit about platelet inhibitors. But also risk factor reduction and preventing vascular injury is important. Avoiding fats, decreasing the amount of cholesterol, minimizing the risk factors can all be an integral component of an overall approach to the management of clots. So I hope this has provided at least a brief introduction, maybe introduce some questions that you might have. There are some resources that are available that I've included on the last slide, which I would encourage you to peruse if you are further interested in anticoagulants or maybe on an anticoagulant. These sites are ones that we use, that I use, that provide information both for healthcare professionals as well as for patients, and often include a list of frequently asked questions or links to other resources that might be useful to you. Individual health plans. I found that often these have a number of great resources as well, online resources with answers to questions about these types of medications. Okay. Well, I hope everyone has a nice evening. Good night.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.